Who's watching your home when you're not there?
It could be a burglar.
Burglars prefer to break in when they think no one is home and no one will stop them.
Don't be an easy target for intruders.
Protect your home with a free security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Pick up your phone now and get free hardware, free medical and fire alerts, and free activation. It's an $850 value. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer, at 1-877-653-8844. You'll get 24-hour protection, and there's no cost for parts or activation. Call now about a free security system monitored by ADT. Call 1-877-653-8844.
$99 installation charge, 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions to this offer and protect your home license numbers.
Call now, 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844.
Blog Talk Radio.
Friday the 13th, 2010, it's 8 p.m., and this is Templar Memorial Day. The reason why I said that is because on October, Friday the 13th in October, way back in the late Middle Ages, the Seneschals of Philip the Fair of France descended on the poor Knights Templar in a nationwide coordinated raid and kicked their doors in and arrested them. And ever since then, Friday the 13th has been considered unlucky. Well, at least it was unlucky for the Templars. Now, tonight, I'm going to lead a discussion, because I want some people to call in on this, if you're up to it, on Hermetic philosophy. And it will go from ancient Alexandria through the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, and on into the modern era. We'll look at the early work of Empedocles, if you please, and Empedocles, if you don't please, and Pythagoras, and the Pomander, and the Asclepius, that's the Hermetic Corpus, and the Emerald Tablet, and the Chaldean Oracles, and we will consider the Gnostic connection, how the Kabbalah arose from Greek, Assyrian, and Gnostic roots, and how it joined with Hermeticism in the Renaissance, and we'll establish why astrology is so important in the magical art. Well, most importantly, however, we will look for the great secret of Hermetic Kabbalistic philosophy. Now, this is the why of magic. This is that holy grail that we search for. This is the reason that we dedicate our lives to an art that destroys the fools and makes the wise immortal. I said I doubt you've ever heard anything like this before, and we're going to try to open the path to enlightenment. Now, nosce te ipsum, which is the way we open correspondence in the OTA, nosce te ipsum means know thyself. That was written over the proscenium of the cave of the Oracle of Delphi. And the answer to that is tu es Deus. You are God. Now, I adopted that charge and response, that motto, back in 1970 when we started the OTA. And you know, I don't believe I fully understood the significance of it then, but I knew that's what we ought to have as a motto, and know yourself, you are God, And we ought to have that as a motto. We ought to strive for that. And I'm very, very glad I did, because eventually I did. I did make that motto. I internalized it to the point where I think I finally understood it. And that's what we're going to discuss tonight, is the reason why we do all this. And you might be asking yourselves, or some of you might be asking yourselves, well, what in the heck are intelligent, in some cases, college-educated PhDs and people with modern people who are well-educated and intelligent and productive, why do they immerse themselves in a practice that seems superstitious? It seems anachronistic in the sense that it's very medieval. These people in these dark rooms and wearing robes and beating drums and ringing bells and chanting and claiming to be in contact with spirits and all this stuff that seems either seems childish or it seems to be very superstitious. Why do we do it? And why have some very, very intelligent, very capable people ever since before the time of Christ? Why have they been doing this, and why have we continued to do it? Well, the reason, of course, is that this art, and magic is an art, by the way. It's an art science, but I think in many ways it's more of an art than a science. And this art holds out the promise to the practitioner, to the aspiring magus. This art holds out the promise of, literally, of immortality. And if you pursue the art the way you should, and if you follow the path the way you should, and if you don't fall into some of the terrible traps along the way, then you actually can achieve immortality. And I know that sounds a bit presumptuous, but I think maybe by the time we get done with this hour, I think you'll, if you pay very close attention, now you folks in the chat room, now, this is going to be heavy, so you really need to listen to this one. By the end of this program, I think, hopefully, that some of you will understand why it is that we can say that the Hermetic art does hold out the promise of immortality for you if you conscientiously pursue it. Now, what I'm going to do at the beginning here is I'm going to read, and I did this to introduce, by the way, I did this dramatic reading of the Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus at the beginning of Rites of Magic, and we have a nice illuminated version of it. So I did that. I'm going to do that again. And what I'm going to do at the end of the show, the end of the hour tonight, we're going to reveal what the secret of the Emerald Tablet is. And we're going to see it by that time, if some of you already know it, you can already guess it. Now, anytime during the program, please call in, especially if you figure out what it is that the big secret of the Emerald Tablet is. If you think you've figured it out, you call in. And I was joking with Sirs Andre before we went on here. Well, you can win the golden apple of the Isle of the Blessed if you if you answer the question. Now, remember, our guest call-in number is 347-857-1830. Call in at any time. I'll repeat that. It's area code 347-857-1830. All right. Now, we'll start off by reading the ancient and mysterious Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus, and you see if you can figure out what the secret ingredient here that Hermes is talking about, what it really is. All right, here we go. True it is, without falsehood, certain and most true, that that which is above is like to that which is below, and that which is below is like to that which is above, to accomplish the miracles of one thing. And as in all things whereby the contemplation of one, so in all things arose from this one thing by a single act of adoption. The father thereof is the son, the mother, the moon. The wind carried it in its womb. The earth is the source thereof. It is the father of all works of wonder throughout the world. The power thereof is perfect. If it be cast onto the earth, it will separate the element of earth from that of fire, the subtle from the gross. With great sagacity it doth ascend gently from earth to heaven. Again it doth descend to earth, and uniteth in itself the force from things superior and things inferior. Thus thou wilt possess the brightness of the world, and all obscurity will fly far from thee. This thing is the strong fortitude of all strength, for it overcometh every subtle thing, and doth penetrate every solid substance. Thus was this world created. Hence will there be marvelous adaptations achieved, of which the manner is this. For this reason I am called Hermes Trismegistus, because I hold three parts of the wisdom of the whole world, and that which I had to say about the apparition of Saul is completed. There, now, that's the mystery of the Emerald Tablet. What is this strange force, this strange element, this strange thing that Hermes is talking about? Well, you think about that, and if you think you've got the answer, you call up and tell me, and you win the golden apple. Well, call anyway if it's on the topic. And then by the end of the program tonight, I believe some of you will begin to get the idea of exactly what this is. And at the end of the show, I promise, and I will tell you. Now, what is Hermetic philosophy? Well, Hermetic philosophy is, you want to describe it technically, it's more Neoplatonic than Gnostic, and it's more, and it is monotheistic, but it is monistic, it's not dualistic. Now, all this, of course, is philosophical gobbledygook, but Hermetic philosophy, as early as we can detect it, began in the Greco, the earliest part of the Greco-Egyptian period. Even before that, it began, as far as we know, with a Greek on the island of Sicily whose name was Empedocles. And Empedocles, and it was a school of Greeks. Empedocles and Epimenides were both working on similar basis. These people were the earliest that we can detect. They were pre-Pythagorean. They very very soon this became Pythagorean philosophy. These people were the first that we know of who contemplated the universe from the point of view of the subjective self, the idea of the self contemplating the universe, and then wondering why the self could contemplate the universe, and wondering then whether or not the self could define the universe. And then trying to find out what the self was, and then trying to find out what its relation to the universe was. This whole process A fellow by the name of James wrote a book on this called The Bicameral Mind, and he got the idea that some kind of mutation occurred in the human mind at that time that enabled them to do this. I don't think this was the case, because Empedocles, Parmenides, and the rest of the Greek philosophers drew upon and venerated the ancient Egyptian ideas of the divisions of the soul. So this is why this Hermetic philosophy that we come up with, even though we can say that this whole idea of the divine self and the divine self being able to access the divine power of God, that this idea started as nearly as we can tell with Empedocles, but it drew upon the ancient Egyptian notions of the divisions of the soul. The transcendental notions of the division of the soul. Like even the old pyramid texts, further back you go, the Egyptians had their concept of immortality and of the souls living on after death and all this. This was very unique to the Egyptians. You know, the Sumerians didn't have anything like this. As far as we know, they didn't have anything like this in Mohenjo-Daro, but the Egyptians, way back 5,000 years ago, they had this concept. But their version of it was very ritualistic and in a sense explained by metaphor, whereas Empedocles, Parmenides, Empedocles, and then the later Pythagoreans, they got into it from a standpoint of examining the whole mystery of the self and the mystery of God and the self. Now, one of the interesting things I'd like to point out here that Parmenides, he is considered to be, believe it or not, the founder of logic. Yeah, Parmenides is considered the founder of logic, and this guy was a full-blown mystic who was ruminating about the special divine nature of the soul and of immortality, and yet we consider him to be the founder of logic for the simple reason that he said, okay, the only thing I really know is that I'm sitting here and I'm me, and I'm nobody else, and what I can see around me, and only this minute, I don't know what I remember might not be true, but what I see right now around me, I can say is real, and I can say this moment is real, and I can say I'm real, and nothing else. That's all I can say. That's it. And I'm not even sure if what I'm looking at is actually real or what. So all I know is that I'm here right now, and that's it. And nothing else can I prove. Everything else has just got to be some sort of a construct. And that's considered to be the start of logic. Well, this kind of contemplation, this is what got James, who wrote this book about the bicameral mind, he got to thinking that this was something unique. Well, the actual contemplation of it may have been. Now, at least as far as we know. Now, this idea, based and following upon and drawing upon the ancient idea, ancient, very ancient Egyptian idea of the transcendence of the soul, began to form a philosophical school in Alexandria during the Ptolemaic period. The Greco-Egyptian period, these thoughts began to form into a philosophy, and this is around about the same time Gnosticism's growing up. Hermeticism is a bit different than Gnosticism. It does draw on it to some degree, but we'll explain that in a minute. But this school of thought got started. Now it was attributed to Hermes Trismegistus. That's a Greek version of the Egyptian god Thoth. And the Greeks, as you probably know, venerated the Egyptians. Plato venerated the Egyptians. All the Greeks philosophers venerated the Egyptians because of this, of the contemplation of the immortal soul that the Egyptians had come up with. So, during this Greco-Egyptian period, say around 200, 300 B.C., they began to develop this line of thought, which eventually culminated in Hermetic philosophy and also in Neoplatonic philosophy after around the time of Jesus, but actually got started before Jesus. In my opinion, now that we know that Hermetic philosophy really did get started before Jesus, it was discredited in the Renaissance and the later Renaissance by saying that, well, it was all post-Christian. But actually, now we know we know that actually it was pre-Christian. So Jesus himself was in a sense a Hermetic philosopher, this got started in this around about 150 100 BC, and what the basis of it was the idea that God. That there was just one God. This was there were other gods under him, but one God was everywhere and everything, and it created the whole universe, good and evil, and everything was created by one God, and the God permeated everything, and he was completely present in everything, and that he had a special, and this is very important, he had a special mission for humanity, that we really were, according, you know, and you see this had an influence, of course, on the Hebrew scholars too, because they said, you know, God created man in his own image. Well, that's a Hermetic concept. So God, according to this philosophy, is in everything, and he creates man to be the regent on the planet, and he is the regent, and he is man. Man is the eyes and the ears of God, and man is the agent of God, and this is affected by a quality called nous. N-O-U-S. It's a Greek word which is not easily translatable, but unfortunately, the earlier translations of the Hermetic treatises, they translated nous as mind. And that's not a good translation, because well, he ended up with the Hermetic treatise where in the Pomander, Hermes says, we have a call coming in. Okay, this is the Hermetic Hour, and you're on the air. Who am I talking with?
Oh, hi. This is Keith in Tucson.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yes,
hey,
hello.
You're
on the air. Yeah.
Oh, hey. Yeah, I'm really enjoying the show thus far, but I was really amazed that you referenced Jane's book, The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. I'm very familiar with the book. I actually have an old hardbound copy of the book. And one of the things about the bicameral mind that James, his theory that he put forth was that not that I believe it one way or the other, but it's an interesting theory, is just that early man in early society was basically what we consider today would be someone who's schizophrenic, more or less, and someone who doesn't have the mind space to think in metaphors or anything, and so they heard voices from God and stuff. And it was only until society became more advanced and more complicated that man was forced into becoming more conscious, and then the voices of the gods start to fall away, and man was forced to evolve. And that was the theory of the breakdown of the bicameral mind.
Yeah, I'm familiar with all that because, of course, I've read the book. But I have to tell you, I don't agree with that. I think that he is that he is fishing for something that that's taken. I think it would it took a much longer time to generate. He's looking at, James is looking at some sort of trying to peg some sort of a mutation at that period. You know, when Empedocles and Parmenides were all of a sudden, well, according to James, all of a sudden they start saying, oh my gosh, we're thinking, you know. Woo,
right,
isn't this wonderful? Yeah, I don't agree with that. I think that this came on gradually. But I do, and I don't think we were necessarily schizophrenic because, you know, as a magician, heck, I talk to spirits on a weekly basis. And granted, yeah, I mean, and I do, and these they don't sound like voices in the next room. They're what we call knowings, but they're very, very powerful. And so, you know, people thought in those days, they thought the dreams came from the gods, and they thought that these intuitions they had came from the gods. And one of the reasons why they did was because they had this idea that they didn't do the Descartes, the Cartesian thing of trying to separate mind, imagination from reality. You
right.
know, and this is one of the problems with James is he doesn't take into consideration the Cartesian revolution, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. One of the things he did point towards, though, which was kind of, you know, he did extrapolate a lot of stuff and made a lot of presumptions and a lot of jumps. But one of the things is that he did point out is that if you look at the history at the times that he was pointing out, there did seem to be some sort of evolutionary shift somehow. I mean, things just changed.
Yeah, I think that's a metaphor. See, this is the thing. It was the metaphor. James, before that time, and even during that time, all the way up through Plato and everything, they still talked about the gods, and they still continued to use mythological metaphors to describe psychic phenomena and just to describe the oracular and the intuitive. They still did, but before that Empedocles and before Parmenides, that was kind of the birth of psychology or parapsychology, if you want to put it that way. And so what you've got here is the Greek process. This is why we call Parmenides the father of logic. Well, Parmenides was a full-blown mystic, but he said, well, why am I me, and what can I say about all of this? And that part of it was new, but I don't think that means that there was any kind of, I don't think our brains changed particularly. I think this is a cultural, you know, this is an evolution of culture and an evolution of a process. But anyway, but James has certainly got people thinking. Let's put it this way. So yeah. James, I'm not really opposed to it. I just think he really got people thinking though, and that was a good thing. Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, and let
all
me
right,
get
great.
Back
Thanks.
To this.
Great show.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Bye bye. I'm glad he called in about James because, James did get this whole thing kicked off, get people thinking about it. Now, along that line, and another book, and it might have been influenced somewhat by James, another book that I really, really want to recommend to people who really want to dig in and get this, and get this and make it yours, is a book by Peter Kingsley called Reality. And this came out in 2000. Fred Adams, my old master who just died last year, Fred Adams had been telling me over and over again, "Book, you got to read this book. You got to read this book." And I kept putting it off and putting it off. And finally, Sister Celine, our own alchemical adept, she just laid a copy of it on my desk and said, "Here, read this." And this book, Reality, 600 pages long, but it's on Parmenides and Empedocles. And at the end, in the end of the book, he lays it out. I mean, you have to wade through a lot of circular Greek philosophy, but by gosh, by the end of it, he's going to lay out immortality for you. And so I highly recommend that Peter Kingsley book. It's called Reality. But to get back to this, the Hermetic treatises, they promoted and extolled this idea that man was divine, and that unfortunately, according to Hermes, yeah, we all are, but there aren't that many of us that know it, and you have to we all have the mind, but we don't have, all of us don't have the nous. In other words, the spiritual consciousness. And he describes the spiritual consciousness, the nature of it. And I'll read here a description of from the Hermetic treatises, the description of this spiritual consciousness here. If I can find it, let's see. Wait a minute. Anyway, I've got this copy of the new translation of the Hermetic treatises, and this is put out by Inner Traditions as the new translation of the Corpus Hermeticum. And definitions of Hermes Trismegistus to Asclepius, translated by Clement Seaman, Doreen von Oven, William Wharton, and Jean-Pierre Mahay. This is the best, and I've read, four different versions of the Hermetic treatises. This is the best one I've ever read. Now, let's see. On page 58, we have the description of the nous. And that, I think, will explain a lot of what this is. Just a moment here. Now, this is Book 12, Chapter 1. Quotat nous comes from God's essence. If indeed he has an essence, what sort of thing this essence is, he alone knows fully. In fact, nous is not separate from God's true essence, but is, as it were, spread out from it, just like the light of the sun. In men, this nous is God. Thus, some men are gods, and then humanity is akin to divinity. In fact, Agathos Daimon called gods immortal men, and men mortal gods. But in irrational creatures, there's just nature. Now, wherever there is a soul, there is also nous. Likewise, wherever there is life, there is also a soul. However, in irrational creatures, the soul of is life devoid of nous. Nous is the benefactor for human souls, for it moves them to the supreme good. And if irrational creatures, in irrational creatures, it works in the nature of each, whereas in men's souls, it counteracts that nature. For every soul, on being born in a body, is immediately corrupted, both by pain and pleasure, and since the body is composed of different parts, both pleasure and pain seethe within it like juices in a stew, and the soul, when it enters into these, is drowned. In other words, what he's saying is you have to you have to meditate, and you have to, you can't just be going around enjoying yourself and entertaining yourself and becoming fascinated by all the pleasures of the flesh. You have to take time to meditate and contemplate, and in order to find those, which is very true, you do. But on the other hand, Hermes, as much as he extols the good and the compassionate life, because naturally all people have a measure of God in them, and so consequently you're supposed to respect all human life but even so, this is a monist philosophy, which means that there is no devil necessarily. There are demons, and there are spirits, and there's good and there's evil, but it all comes from God. And Hermes says on several occasions that to the pure all things are pure. In other words, the morality in the Hermetic tradition, morality is designed to let you find the nulls and celebrate the nulls over the distractions of the flesh. But it is not a Christian or Jewish type morality where you're going to be damned to hell if you don't, or anything like that. But you are, however, cautioned against hurting other people, because they are creatures of God also. Now let's do another quote here from Hermes on the nulls. Without nulls, the soul cannot say anything or do anything. Often nulls leaves the soul at such a time, and the soul neither sees nor hears, but is like a dumb creature, such as the power of nulls. But it leaves such a soul tied to the body and suffocated by it here below. Such a soul, my son, has no nulls, and therefore such a one should not be called a man. For man is a divine being and is not to be counted amongst the other creatures on earth, but amongst those in heaven, called gods. Indeed, if we have to speak the truth boldly, the true man is above the gods, or at least fully their equal in power. Now this is the reason why, during the Renaissance, the magical writer, the modern magical writer, Dame Frances Yates, said that this Asclepius, from which this is from, was the charge of dynamite behind Renaissance Neoplatonism. Now, we referred to this as Neoplatonism. Plotinus was a later Platonic philosopher who developed what we call the emanation theory, which has since been become a very integral part of Hermetic teaching. Now, one of the things that I want to point out, staying with it, I know this is a very complex subject, but let's get back to our outline here and say that the Gnostics, which we're, I think, all familiar with, that they did contribute to this, and they rose up around the same time as this philosophy. But the Gnostics were dualists, and they believed that the world was. Oh, I got another caller. Okay, you're on the air of the Hermetic Hour. Who am I speaking with?
Hi, Mr. Runyon. This is your admirer.
Oh, yeah.
I know who that admirer is.
Right. What can I do for you, sister?
We have a discussion going on, and this is actually Sister S, and we have a little discussion going on in the blog, and we're talking about the soul and the angels, and if we wanted to ask you if you consider the angelic selves and us to be two separate things, or if we're empowered, all of us, by God, or a lot going on in that little blog box.
Well, spirit in Hermetic philosophy, before it became blended with Kabbalah, and I was going to discuss that in a little bit, how the Kabbalistic Hermetic philosophy actually had an influence on Kabbalah. and then Kabbalah, then they loop back, and Kabbalah and Hermetic philosophy got unified. But so I think we can answer the question for both Hermetic and Kabbalistic philosophy that angels are messengers of God, and they actually, in some respects, they're not as creative as men, as people are, because human beings have the power to procreate, and this is a tremendous power. Angels don't have this. Angels are messengers of God, whereas what you might want to call demons, if you're a dualist, let's just say spirits, are disembodied entities that can be human beings that are hanging around, though they can be elementals, they can be embodied spirits that in and of themselves are not they don't have the full range of action that people do. Really, according to Hermetic philosophy, and I think Kabbalistic philosophy also, because the two of them are very closely related, human beings, if they realize it, and if they have the nous, are actually more powerful and have a further range of power than the angels or the spirits. Does that answer your question?
Thank you very much, Father.
Okay, thanks. Nice for calling.
Really lovely. Thank you, show. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Anyway, I'm going to catch up here back to our outline. Okay, the Gnostics had this, they had a kind of a negative idea about the world. I mean, they thought it was controlled by an evil demiurge, and we had to get loose from this evil demiurge, and then we would climb back up through the spheres. Well, this is not the way the Hermetic philosophy went. Hermetic philosophy said the world's a great place. I mean, it's a wonderful place. It's beautiful. But instead of being trapped by an evil demiurge, man is trapped by his own just lust for the pleasures of the flesh and everything else. And if he really wants to take control of his incarnations and take control of his immortality, then he needs to take the time to meditate, become spiritual. And now let's say this, that one of the basic factors of Hermetic, one of the basic things in Hermetic science is the idea of reincarnation and immortality. This is a given. This is not anything that you have to, as far as Hermetic philosophy is concerned, that you have to prove. We just know it's true. And the reason why we know it's true is the whole idea, and this is where Empedocles and the Jains thing and all this comes in. The reason why we know it's true that we are immortal is because we of the great I Am. That's the great I Am. Now, we give Moses some credit for the great I Am. I think he deserves some credit. Because when God first appeared to Moses, Moses said, Well, who shall I tell the people, that you are? And he says, I am. And Moses said, well, I can't go back and tell them that I am. But that's what God said. Now, if you really want to be, esoteric, you can say the whole Kabbalah just starts right there with I am. Because if I am means that he is, and if he is, so are you, because I am, and you are I am. And now some people say, of course, because of this, that Popeye is God. You know, Popeye said, I am what I am, and it's all what I am. Well, that's true. But more profoundly than that, the great I am is the reason why you are immortal, is because you have the consciousness. Nobody else has it that you know of. You assume they do, but then you've got it. And so, and the consciousness, if you had the knowledge, that's the spiritual consciousness, that's God. So you got it. So you're going to keep it because you've got it, and nobody else has. And it's not going to die because that consciousness is not going to die. Now, if you can grasp that, that's hard to grasp. Very hard to grasp. For most people, it takes years of study to grasp this. This is not a philosophy that people want you to even contemplate. Freud, by the way, came up with a definition for it. He called it the oceanic feeling or the oceanic sense, and he didn't like it. And it was like when he and Jung got to talking about, and Jung came up with his archetype theory, and Freud said, "Ah, because we must promote the doctrine of sex, because if we don't, we will release a black flood of occultism." Well, the oceanic feeling, Freud felt the same way about that. He said, "This has no place in my psychology." But the oceanic feeling is the idea of your complete connection with nature, where you feel your consciousness, it's what Walter Stace referred to as undifferentiated unity, the mystical experience, where you are completely in touch with nature, and nature's completely in touch with you, and it's on a personal basis. Now, there's a philosophical term for this called solipsism. Now, solipsism means a self-centered philosophy, a philosophy that extols the self. And the word's almost disappeared from usage. Nobody talks about it. In the modern world, nobody wants you even thinking about this. They don't. This is something that it has a relationship to Romanticism. And during the Romantic period, there were a number of people who resurrected this. This is why the Hermetic philosophy is so popular during the Romantic period, because of this essential doctrine of solipsism, which if you embrace it, and you realize that this is the secret of immortality. Now, I've come up with a term to link the two called romantic solipsism, and that's my term for describing the magical philosophy. Now, the Gnostics contributed was the whole idea of the ascension up the spheres. And one of the reasons move along with this outline here, we can cover this, the rest of this. One of the reasons why astrology is part of Hermetic philosophy, along with alchemy, of course, one of the reasons why astrology is so important is because if you are going to act as God, and if you are going to control the universe, and you're going to use this godlike power to control events, then you need to be able to have rules and have a system for every bit of the universe you can perceive, as far out as you could perceive it. Yeah. Just like Enoch, you've got to get up there and you've got to find out what makes everything move and be the master of the moon and the tides and the stars and everything else. And so, therefore, astrology came in very, very early on, became the magician's operative philosophy, because it was that huge, great universe. And the furthest out he could see, beside the stars, which he thought were on a sphere of their own, the planet, the furthest out planet they could see was Saturn. So that's why in the Kabbalah and in the Hermetic Kabbalah, the physical universe begins with Saturn. And that's why we ascend back up from the Earth sphere on up through the moon and on up to Saturn. We come down there, come down that way from the zodiac, and we come on down that way, and we're born, and then when we die, we go back up that way, and that's the great ladder, the great Hermetic Kabbalistic ladder. Now, reason why astrology is so important is it is our operative philosophy. And when we're talking about astrology now, we're talking about elective astrology. We're talking about astrology where you take control. You find out when and all when the heavens are right, and then you do what you want to do based upon where they're at. Now, so astrology is really important for expanding your universe. If you're going to be God, then you better have your whole universe under control. So that's why we do that. Now, what we might say is this, that astrology, of course, was in those days geocentric, and they weren't quite sure how much credit to give to the precession and various things like that, and they couldn't see any further out than Saturn, so that was the only, you know, that was the end of the planet. Now, so therefore, why did it work? Well, it worked because they wanted it to, and it worked because it was the system they perceived. Now, this is a little hard to grasp, but if you think about it, you know, in relation to Hermetic philosophy, you can see where it works. If you have a system, even if it's not correct, if it's what you see and it's logical and it works for you, and you've gone ahead and expanded your colleagues, they agree with it and everything, and you got it, it'll work. Yeah, it sure will. Now, today we know that there are planets beyond Saturn. And we know that there's Uranus and Neptune and Pluto. Well, I guess Pluto's been deplanetized, but we're not going to go along with that. There's some other scientists. Now, we know there's Pluto out there. So today, we need, in our elective astrology, our magical astrology, we need to include Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. Why? Why do we need to include them? Well, it worked just as well when we didn't include them. But we need to include them simply because we know they are there. That's all. If you don't know they're there, astrology will work for you just as well. If you do know they're there, then you better include them. That's Hermetic philosophy. And if you're with me, if you follow me so far, you can realize that is really how it's going to work. Now, does all this actually work? You better believe it does. And one of the reasons why we study all this and why we do these operations is not so much for the result of the operation. It's not to win the lottery or to get the right sex partner or any of the or the right job or whatever. I've used it for that purpose. But the real reason why we do all this is to prove to ourselves that it works. We're proving, the magician is proving to himself that he is the representative of God and that he can make the universe work. Now, the universe really does work this way. And we've proved now in physics that the observer can influence the experiment. Now I'm going to get into, very briefly, I'm going to get into that other branch of Hermetic science. I consider the Kabbalah Hermetic, definitely. And of course we blended it with Hermetic science in the Renaissance anyway, but it originally was Hermetic to start with. And now we're going to discuss alchemy. Now, alchemy works. It works not because it's scientific, and it works on the principles that are kind of, you might say, whimsical. You might say obsolete, you might say superstitious, you might say a whole bunch of things about alchemy to discredit it, but alchemy works, and it works for one reason, because the alchemist doesn't just bring something to a temperature as quickly as he can, like in chemistry. The alchemist slow cooks everything he does. He's like a gourmet chef, and he's got those molecules agitated, and just agitated just enough. And then his intent and his belief and his desire and his will, while they're simmering on, and while he's changing them, he's calcinating them, he's transmuting them, and he's letting them ferment, and he's distilling them, and he's doing all this stuff to them, and all the time he's doing this, his will and his desire is affecting them. And that's why it works. Then we are now realizing in physics, in actual physics, they're realizing that this is the case. The observer will influence the experiment. And we've seen that we can change the molecular compositions of elements. We can do all these things by willpower. But the alchemist, when he sets out, he's actually got his laboratory, and he is working, and he's agitating them, and he's doing all these things. So some of the things that the alchemist did were amazing. Now, why can't we credit alchemy, and why don't we do more with it? Well, for one simple reason. An individual alchemist can accomplish miracles, what other people would think of miracles, but he could write down all of this that he's done very, very carefully, write the whole thing down, give it to another alchemist, and have the other alchemist try to do it and not be successful. Because there's two different people here working, and you don't know how much the other alchemist can focus his knowledge, how much he focuses his belief on all of this. It's that factor. It is that divine knowledge, that divine will, that divine effort, that divine concept, that divine belief, that's what does it. And now let's look back at the Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus. What was this ingredient, this mysterious force, this mysterious element that Hermes is talking about, this thing that is the great force that separates and that accomplishes and does all these things that Hermes is talking about in the Emerald Tablet? What is it? Well, by now you ought to know. It's will and desire. Desire. Love. Empedocles, back 520 BC, said everything can be reduced to air, earth, fire, water, love, and strife. Everything. And the whole universe. Air, earth, fire, water, love, and strife. Now, it's love. I remember Curly said, love is the law, love under will. He was right about that. Love under will. And I also, we could say, do what thou wilt, show me the whole of the law. In this case, love is the law under will, and it's very true. The problem, of course, with that is that you should will what's good and what's right and what does not harm other people. And that's why the witches added to that and said, and ye harm none, do what you will. But still, love is the force. Love is the force that congeals it, puts it together, holds it together, and makes it. Remember, the internal combustion engine is far more efficient than it ought to be, and the reason why it is because we want it to be. The bumblebee can't fly, but the bumblebee wants to, and God wants the bumblebee to fly, so it does. And we can, the human imagination, the greatest force in the whole universe. And that is the secret behind hermetic science, and that is why we are immortal. And that is why we can be like gods, but it's a tremendous responsibility. And fortunately, a lot of people don't seem to understand it. Otherwise, how many magicians can this planet handle? I think that Hermetic philosophy is really, really wonderful. And, of course, I think it is the road to enlightenment. Now, I want to recommend that Corpus Hermeticum book. Next week, we'll be back on Thursday, and we'll get out another topic for you. And so we'll be back on Thursday on regular schedule. And meanwhile, have a good one, and we'll see you next Thursday. Good magic.